keep it alive through these lines I write. I keep it live cause I thrive. I might just blow your mind tonight. I'm so hyped, but it's no hype. From this height, it's direct hits on sight. I'm your type, lend me your ears to show you that there's something in me. I'm not giving up, I'm standing right here holding these days hostage, and I'll make this my year. We turning fear into love, and the love's in the air. I love doing this cause nothing compares, nothing can share that same type of feeling. When you feeling them flare, they can't catch it, it's havoc. I rip to a tear, switch the scenario, my stereos, I leave them impaired. Variables start to change, and they're all in my range. I just gotta grab it, it's all mathematics. Every step is drastic, I make it fantastic. I'm trying to take your breath away, asthmatic.
This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo. This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go through the stereo, stereo.
Yeah. Just nod your head with it, so explicit and vivid. Every image is intricate, intimate. I put my all into it, no scrimmage and no rules. I'm a pro tool, hear my heartbeat beat into the vocals. I'm so loco, lost my mind, oh no. It's ponderoso, dope so, no overdose cause it's dope, yo. Man, this is house grown, mixed with some milestones. So I let the style flow, down like the Dow Jones. Bringing it with some foul tones, letting the crowd know we getting loud, so it's eardrum rudiments. Yeah, we bring it rude again. Move, little hooligan. Music for tuning in. Full time to the 10. I'm on my clock, like I told you. I'm doing this for dreams we pursuing.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Anti-Media Radio Show. Once again, with your host, Nick Burnaby, here on UCY.TV. Thank you all for tuning in, and I'm really happy to be back with you tonight. I'm happy to be alive, and man, so many crazy things going on with this election. Just can never put your finger on one thing because it's just nonstop, right? And you know, we're dealing with a bunch of things going on. Our website is something, I don't know, something happened to our site. We're like under attack right now or something, but we're working on it. We're fixing it. We're going to have a great show for you tonight. A bunch of interesting analysis on the antimedia.org that I really want to talk about, because it's really important to look at the deeper issues here, because it's not just like what we're being told on TV. It's not just what your friends are telling you. I mean, there's a lot bigger, deeper themes here that we need to talk about. And I wrote about one of them today, and this is really a counter-narrative to the point that I've been saying throughout the mainstream media. And I mean, the myth of objectivity is completely gone now. I mean, these media outlets are literally completely saying, look, Trump is so bad that we're going to back Clinton. And, you know, at least they're coming out and saying it now, because this has kind of been something that media outlets have been doing for a long time. They back candidates, but they do it in a – they try to be a little more discreet about it, I guess you could say. I think a lot of people don't really buy into the myth of objectivity. We all know the New York Times is biased. We all know CBS, ABC, NBC, Washington Post, all completely biased organizations, but they pretend to be unbiased. And you know, it's kind of a good thing, I guess, now that they're coming out and just saying it, hey, we're backing Clinton because Trump's crazy. Because now people can see, okay, they are like really tampering with the elections and stuff like that. I mean, part of the reason why I started the anti-media was because I realized this was going on back in 2012 when I was closely following the Ron Paul campaign, and he was like completely ignored in the presidential debates and all that stuff. And I'm like, oh shit, man, this media is horribly biased, but they pretend like they're not. Like, they get away with pretending to be objective, but they're completely not. So that's one of the reasons why we put the anti-media out there, to try to challenge this narrative and stuff. So one of the things that I covered today that I wrote about over on the antimedia.org is titled, Don't Throw Away Your Vote by Voting for Clinton or Trump. Because, you know, like I said, the media is saying it, and everybody, a bunch of my liberal friends have other liberal friends that are saying, you know, anybody questioning whether or not they're going to vote for Clinton, it's like, oh my God, do you want Trump to win? It's like, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying I'm not going to vote for Hillary Clinton. That's what people don't understand. And there's just this really bad cognitive dissonance going on where people are kind of saying, well, if you vote for anyone other than Clinton, you're basically voting for Trump. And it's, you know, I hate to break it to you, but when you vote for someone, your vote goes towards, you know, in theory, goes to that person that you're voting for. You know, if you vote for a third party candidate, like, for instance, Jill Stein, instead of voting for Clinton, you're not voting for Trump, you're voting for Jill Stein. I mean, this idea that, like, one vote for someone is actually a vote for someone else, it doesn't make any sense. It's not realistic. And even if that were the case, I mean, people, if they're saying that, then they admit that we're not living in a democratic society. And then they still want to make the case that, well, if you don't, I mean, it's just such a self-defeating argument. It really makes me kind of angry that people use it so often. You know, but it's used very often, and it's used effectively, and it's really a way to bully people into voting for someone who they may or may not agree with. And to me, that's just not the right way to go about, you know, getting people into your camp and getting people to vote for your candidate of choice. You don't do it by bullying them and scaring the hell out of them. Well, do you want Donald Trump to drop a nuclear bomb on everybody? If you don't think that's a good idea, then vote for Clinton, because that's the only way to stop him. It's kind of like scare tactics and just fear porn propaganda. I mean, it's kind of really the tactic used by people like Alex Jones, but now it's being deployed by liberals on Facebook, and it's just so just ridiculous that I had felt like compelled to call it out. I think we're being joined now by my co-host, DB Schwartz. DB, are you on the line?
Yeah, I am, Nick. I was just going to say, man, did you mention Fox? Because they're legit now.
What?
I was going to say, I didn't hear you mention them, but I guess because they're the only one now who even dares to try to go against the official narrative. I was watching something earlier where they're even turning against Trump. So the Republican, supposedly the Republican channel is now turning against Trump. So they're all one party. I mean, if that doesn't tell you it, I don't know what would.
Yeah, I mean, Fox News, is their bias has been, well, Fox and MSNBC both, their bias has been out of the bag for a long time. Everybody kind of knows that. If you're watching Fox, it's going to be pro-Republican establishment, and if you're watching MSNBC, it's going to be pro-Democratic establishment. But most of the other ones kind of have this way of reporting where it makes it kind of seem like they're not choosing sides. But the thing is that they choose sides by on certain things and choosing not to report on certain things. I mean, for instance, what went on with the DNC and the revelations out of WikiLeaks that we've been talking about pretty much nonstop here on the anti-media. One of the things that we saw happen here was that instead of the mainstream media focusing in on the fact that the DNC was like really stacking the deck against Sanders, they immediately took the bait from the Clinton campaign where she was like, oh, it's the Russians, or the Russians are the ones that did it. They're the ones that are responsible for this. And that became the media narrative. The media narrative became, instead of, oh my God, the DNC is you know, manipulating the election, and you know, who's to say whether this election is actually legitimate now because it was manipulated, to saying, well, no, the Russians are trying to manipulate the election. It's not us, it's the Russians. And the media just totally went with it. They were like just waiting on something to pounce on to change the subject. And, you know, that's what they did. And so, you know, it really shows how much the media wants to manipulate things. And now Trump is being painted as like the Russian-backed candidate for 2016. But, you know, the whole point of this article is that you don't have to vote for Trump or Clinton. In fact, voting for Trump or Clinton, you're basically wasting your vote, because these are two individuals who are either part of the political establishment or are going to become part of the political establishment once they're elected. The Republican and Democratic parties have been for a long time sold out and completely controlled. And as multiple, you know, studies have shown, I mean, the U.S. really acts more like an oligarchy. So it doesn't matter if it's the Republican, the Democrat, your candidate, their candidate, whoever's candidate, if they're part of this system and they get into power, they're going to maintain the oligarchy. And therefore, if you vote for Trump or Clinton, You're wasting your vote. You're throwing it away. You're saying, I'm okay with the status quo. I'm okay with the oligarchy. I'm okay with you guys never listening to us. I'm okay with you guys taking all this money from who knows who and doing carrying out legislation that benefits only the rich, because that's what happens. I mean, the data is there. The data shows that in the United States, 90% of legislation that is passed favors the rich. Only 10% of it favors the voter, the taxpayer. So, you know, it doesn't matter who you choose here on the Republican or Democratic side. You're wasting your vote because they're not going to listen to you anyway. You might as well be setting your ballot on fire. I mean, that would do just about as much good as picking Trump or Clinton. But, you know, the argument I make here in my article is that if you want your vote to count, you should vote your conscience. You should vote someone other than a Republican, other than a Democrat, or, you know, or withdraw your vote altogether. Because
Nick, I think I touched on it last time that at this point, until the voting machines are, you know, basically done away with, and until all the votes are hand counted, you know, and to make sure that the numbers correlate, it's all a moot point anyway, because they can put in anybody they want, manipulate any of the data, and the average person still watches the news and listens to the radio and reads the paper and believes it. And it's still a huge portion of the population, even younger people, that believe some of the corporate media. And it's not going to stop until, you know, something makes it stop. Some kind of calamity happens or some war pops up in the middle of nowhere and people don't even know why because they've been lied to so long. But, I mean, what's going on is it's insane, dude.
Exactly. And, you know, They still have to manipulate the public opinion, because if the opinion doesn't line up with the results, then people are going to know something is up. And so the media still has to manipulate people into believing that, okay, it's Clinton and Trump and no one else.
But it's so not. Like, if there was any, if Jill Stein had federal funding and if people even knew who she was, and if people weren't dumb enough to believe that she's anti-vax and all these other propaganda puff pieces starting to come out, if we just had an educated, non-fluoridated population, we could overthrow these people, man. The military will do whatever the people tell them to do. So, like, we're going to just get stuck in this perpetually until something pops off. That's the whole thing, man. I think I was talking with somebody today about how the think tanks that control the U.S. are planning on a war that's going to kill a lot of people here and wipe out any opposition. That's what they're planning for, dude, and they're setting it up.
Well, you know, we got to do what we can to make sure that doesn't happen, you know, but the fact of the matter is the country is more divided now than ever because of this media manipulation, because of all the post 9/11 propaganda. That's what, you know, laid the groundwork for Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump's, you know, the founding fathers of Donald Trump's campaign was everybody that in the media that carried out the propaganda after 9/11. All of this anti-Islam propaganda, demonization. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that's very calculated, because they have to demonize Muslims. If we're going to go rampaging through the Middle East, we can't have people back at home thinking, oh my God, we're hurting innocent people over there in Iraq. I mean, sure, Saddam Hussein's a bad guy, but do we really got to kill a million innocent people just to get Saddam Hussein? If the public was like thinking in this way and like really challenging that idea that we need to go kill a million people, you know, the wars wouldn't be able to happen. So after 9/11, I mean, the media went into high gear and they started doing, you know, Islamophobic propaganda that way we can get away with going in and starting wars up in Iraq and in Afghanistan and then in Libya and then in Syria and all these different countries where we've really either, you know, started or are backing a proxy war in Yemen as well. You know, our government gets away with it because the media already did the groundwork where we demonize the hell out of everybody that lives over there. So it doesn't matter if we bomb a hospital or we kill a million Iraqis or 50,000 Libyans dead, 300,000 Syrians, no big deal. In fact, I mean, these people have been so dehumanized that now people are even like anti-refugee. I mean, how bad... You know, how effective is the propaganda when people are blaming refugees as if refugees are the problem and as if refugees are like taking over the world? I mean, these are people trying to get away from dying. They're not trying to come take over your country. They're not trying to come, you know, take your jobs and stuff. They're trying to not die, you know. But the propaganda is so effective that Trump could sit here and run on a anti-refugee platform and people eat it up because the propaganda has been so effective. And that's what I find so entertaining about the New York Times and about Washington Post. New York Times recently ran an article basically talking about how now it's okay for the media to let go of all objectivity because of Trump. I mean, we all have to stop Trump. And this is the argument that New York Times was making, is that, you know, all journalists out there, you know, you wouldn't, you know, you're supposed to not choose sides. You're supposed to remain objective. And I know this sounds like taboo, but because of Donald Trump, you know, let go of the objectivity and let's do everything we can to stop Trump. And basically what they're saying is to elect Hillary Clinton. These are the same media outlets that created the anti-Islamic fervor that is electing Trump right now, that is giving Trump his support. You know, and so that's what's so hypocritical about it, is that these media outlets are like, oh my God, this is so irresponsible what Trump is saying and what he's doing. It's like, you guys have been saying this for the past 15 years, you know, and all of a sudden it's like it's a bad thing to be Islamophobic. You guys have been telling us to be that way for a long time. Islamophobia didn't come out of nowhere. Islamophobia is not inherent. You're not born with some kind of you know, instinct to not be okay with Muslims. That's just not how it works. Islamophobia comes from someone telling you to be Islamophobic, and that's what New York Times, Washington Post, all these people have been doing for the last 15 years to justify our wars in the Middle East. And you know, now it's come home to roost. Donald Trump can come and talk about being openly Islamophobic, openly talking about banning Muslims from coming into the country, openly talk about deporting Mexicans and immigrants and stuff like that. And then, you know, and then these media outlets are like shocked, like, oh my God, how's it happening? It's like so obvious, man. But people have such a short attention span. They don't remember the stuff that has been said in the past. So, you know, New York Times before the election could be, you know, covertly Islamophobic. And then now that Trump is being overtly Islamophobic, it's like, oh my God, this is unacceptable.
Well, Nick, what is government except to the governing of the mental abilities, the governing of the mind, the control of minds? I mean, it's simply just a PR campaign, and it has a bunch of dudes with guns that back it up for people that don't get swept into the PR campaign, that controls the opposition, that controls it or kills it, and therefore establishes and maintains a monopoly. And when the monopoly spreads beyond geographical and cultural borders, you get empire, which is what we have. And it never lasts. It always collapses in on itself. Maybe we'll be the final empire. I don't know, Nick. That to me seems like something that couldn't really happen at this point in time. And we're along for that crazy ride, that crazy attempt.
Who knows, man? Who knows what's going to happen? And like you said, you're right, dude. I mean, the only thing that gives legitimacy to everything going on right now, whether it's with the government, with the elections, with the police, with the empire, it's the conquering of the mind, and it's our belief that this is something that is working. And the same thing with the monetary system, the paper money. I mean, it's paper money. It's $100 bill is a piece of paper with numbers printed on it. And if you believe that's $100, then it's worth $100. If you don't believe it's worth $100, then it's not.
Well, Nick, I mean, think about it. At least 80% of the U.S., I know, at least for our country, is probably urban, right? And probably pretty much inner city, at most maybe their suburbs. So what's all that paper worth if tomorrow the trucks stop coming with food and the water stops pumping out of the faucet? I mean, that's what we need to get to, is the reality that if there's a hiccup even in the system where there's 2 weeks or 2 months, or what if even there was a solar flare and it took them 2 years to get electricity back? I mean, people overnight can't get into even the mindset that we can't go get food if we need it, or water. We actually have to go find it or pump it or build things. I mean, because all this stuff's running on stuff that needs to be trucked in or shipped. I mean, we're all interdependent on a system that it really is bound to collapse. You can't just keep printing in infinity. I mean, you can, I guess. We can be at war forever. But one day we go to war and they fight back and we get hit here and then it's on. I mean, nobody wants that to happen.
And the problem is that these systems are highly centralized. I mean, the monetary system is controlled by the Federal Reserve, and they dictate the monetary policy. The energy system in the United States is, for the most part, dictated by the fossil fuel industry, oil, you know, fracking and all the power generation stations that create power. I mean, these are just targets waiting to get attacked or waiting to get disrupted or waiting for a power outage or something, you know, or a power surge, a solar flare. I mean, any of these scenarios could happen that could disrupt the highly centralized system. And then our form of government, highly powerful centralized government, you know, and as long as we believe in that power, it's going to keep on telling us what to do. And so, you know, it's really essential here to emphasize, and we've kind of gotten away from this vision that we used to always talk about, DB. As far as building a democratic society, it's not so much about voting for any politician or whatever. It's really about the idea of decentralization of power and of pretty much everything, and getting the means of production back into your own hands, getting the power production back into your own hands or within your community, getting food production back into your community, and the defense of your community should be in the hands of your community as well. We shouldn't be sitting here relying on the cops or the military to defend our communities. I mean, that's the problem, is that the military takes its orders from, you know, the Pentagon. The cops take their orders from, you know, corrupt bureaucrats that run your cities and all the other federal type of cops and agencies and all that, DHS and all that stuff. I mean, we know where they take their orders from. We need to elevate this principle of decentralization and autonomy, and that's the only way to bring democracy back. I mean, voting for any of these assholes, or, you know, even voting for the better candidates, whether it's, you know, libertarian or green or independent, first of all, very slim chances that they're going to win, especially in this election when everyone is still completely brainwashed by this two-party thing. Maybe that's coming to an end in the next election, but for now, we're stuck with this two-party thing. You know, voting for these guys is not really going to help your situation. Decentralizing the necessities for life is what really is going to bring democracy back, and it's really about democratizing resources and power and access.
That's a horrifying statement, Nick, that it's going to necessitate it coming back, meaning we will at some point have either a big or small hiccup. And I think that a lot of the paranoia people have about the government preparing for a mass casualty event isn't unfounded, because even if we have a two-week hiccup, anybody who's a vulnerable person, older, sick, the very young, they all run the risk of being at risk, dude, of dying even in a two-week hiccup. That's what we need to start kind of gearing up as a society for, because we know it's going to come. There's going to be that kind of lull or a crash of the dollar where they try to maybe take it to an all electronic currency, like it seems like they're testing out with Bitcoin to see if people accept it in mass. But I mean, we will have that hiccup. It's going to be very real at some point. And if you have, you know, a month or two of food and water, you probably will be okay. But I mean, not everybody will, and then of course that starts the panic.
I always go back to when we had that big power outage in Southern California, and I think, DB, you were still around when that happened. And the power for like San Diego County and parts of Orange County got knocked out, and the panic set in within hours, man. And you know, people that weren't prepared to defend their stuff or weren't stocked up on groceries. In my case, I didn't have any gas in my car. And, you know, when the electricity goes out, the gas stops pumping. And I was pretty much stuck. Luckily, I was able to borrow a car from some, you know, a family member who had gas, and I was able to get some of the things done I needed to get done. But if it weren't for that, I'd have been stuck. And that was that power outage lasted for less than a day, and everybody was losing it. Stores got looted. You know, fights were breaking out. People were getting desperate within hours, dude. And
well, if things are tough for us, they're just as tough for cops. So what cops do is they go home and they hole up with their families. And I mean, I've talked to a cop about what would happen. He said, hey, you know what? We've all said that the armory's at the station, so we'll just bring our families to the station and we'll hole up.
Well,
that's what they'll do. They're not going to be out keeping law and order.
Yeah, it's like what happened during Hurricane Katrina, right? The same kind of thing happened. The cops abandoned and the cops left and they took care of their own and they left everyone else to fend for themselves. You know, these cops are, they're around when everything's fine and, you know, they're here to shoot down unarmed people in the streets and arrest the occasional drug dealer. But when shit hits the fan, the cops aren't going to protect you.
They'll be trying to take what you got. They'll get away with it too because they'll be able to say, well, I was an agent of the state and it was an emergency.
Exactly, and you don't want the military coming in and doing the National Guard thing either. And that's it. Again, going back to community self-defense and things like that. I mean, these are ideas that are maybe they may be frowned upon. They may seem unorthodox, but they're ideas that will come into play when we need them, and they should be thought about because we continue relying on this hierarchy. Whether it's economically, you know, financially, for our food, for whatever aspect we're talking about here, health, if we depend on this highly centralized hierarchy, I mean, in a time of distress, these things will fail us. You know, we don't want to be failed by these institutions. We should have replacements in place that are better and that are more accessible to the communities. This is the most important thing to think about. It's not whether Trump is going to be elected or whether we have to stop Trump or how bad Clinton's going to be or any of that stuff. I mean, the presidents are inevitably going to continue these wars, whether they want to or not. And I genuinely think Obama probably didn't want to have all these wars. He probably did want to stop the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, but he got in there and he found out, okay, that's not going to happen because, you know, these people tell me I have to do this or that.
But honestly, what does he care, man? I mean, do you really think he's not just an actor? I mean, he's one of the best. So he reads a teleprompter better than anyone I've ever seen. So he's a lot like Trump. Trump can just shoot off the hip. He's an actor. I mean, it's been proven now he got paid by the DNC. I don't know if you saw that WikiLeaks, Nick. But he was paid, him and his foundation and his, especially his sons, were paid somewhere north of $40 million over the last several years from the DNC, man. The DNC even paid Ted Cruz. So they're all actors. I mean, they're not. I highly doubt that most of these guys even end up going and voting on any bills. I mean, there's proof that there'll be like one guy there voting for like five people that aren't even there. They just push their buttons on their desks. And there's these huge voting blocks of these old guys that just make all the laws. And the rest are just actors. If you saw them in the presidential race, they're an actor. Except for Hillary, which is why she's so terrifying.
Oh, man. Interesting stuff here. I want to break from the stuff we covered on the site and talk a little bit about the Sanders campaign because he is put out an alert today that he's trying to keep his revolution going. I don't know if a lot of his people are still engaged or if they're still following what he's saying or not. I know a lot of
the GNC did a lot, Nick. I don't know if you watched Julian Assange's little speech to the Green at National Convention and all their delegates. They took it, ironically enough, it was in Houston. And you know who Jill Stein picked? I can't remember his name now. Is it Amaru? Whoever Jill Stein picked for her VP apparently is like a foreign, you know, policy like guru. So there's a lot of, like, I don't know, there's not really a rift. Like, I think what's going on is people are trying to change and infiltrate from the inside, but at this point, the political machinery just grinds you with its gears if you get in the way. So I think Bernie found that out. He's like, there's only so much I can do from within the Democratic Party, like, but I don't want to lose the power I have. That's where you get stuck, where if you're kind of establishment, you really can't do much. But I guess you can definitely affect down ticket candidates.
Yeah, I think Bernie really, you know, got the got a dose of reality there when he started hitting a vein of support with the populace because nobody was really having Clinton. I mean, she was kind of spoon fed, and everybody, you know, it was just inevitable that Clinton was going to be the nominee. And I think a lot of Democrats were just kind of like, I don't know, man. She's just not that likable. She's got all this baggage. And
once you watch Clinton Cash, though, Nick, if I tell anybody to watch that, they're like, is that real? And I'm like, that's tame. Like, it doesn't really go into what's been even going on recently, which is where people are just ending up dead. I mean, we can go down that road maybe another show, but people end up dead that try to take them down. But, I mean, every empire, be it a country or a criminal organization, has their end.
Yeah. You know, and I think the Sanders camp really got a sniff of what the reality was like out there. It's not nice. And, you know, they were kind of grinded by the gears, like you mentioned. And it's really sad to see a lot of these people in the wake of what happened. But at the same time, it's a little bit, you know, encouraging, because now people are starting to see, okay, we now know that the system is completely corrupt and it needs to be fixed. We need to do something about it. You know, and try to figure a way out to go about doing it, I guess. But, you know, one of the things that I was always kind of skeptical about with Bernie Sanders was that, you know, there was always that thought in the back of my mind that I kind of knew that this was going to happen and that he wasn't going to be the nominee and stuff. And I was never a Bernie Sanders supporter because I've been a little bit cynical of the democratic process, especially here in the United States since 2012. As I mentioned earlier in the show, I got disillusioned with it, and, you know, for good reason. But, you know, I think now about the Bernie revolution, and man, he had millions and millions of people that voted for him, many of which are people, you know, typical Democrats that were just like, okay, yeah, no, Clinton is not a good choice. We need someone else. And many of which are new people to the voting process that voted for Sanders, first-time voters, young people, millennials, high schoolers, college students, and stuff like that.
And this whole thing has left him incredibly jaded, but at the same time, I thought maybe, like, they would get bored or tired or just lazy, because everybody says, oh, the millennial younger generation are lazy. Well, no, they're not. There's just not any jobs anymore. They actually are the most educated generation ever in this country. So a lot of them have 2 degrees because they can't get a job. So they just go back to school hoping they can get a job with a second degree. So that's all a moot point.
Yeah.
But at any rate, a lot of them have decided to tune out, but a lot of them have decided to get pissed off. And because the internet, really what it allows you to do is, if you're an introvert or if you're someone that's not a I want to go to physically go somewhere person, you can still affect huge change from right in the comfort of your own home, especially if you're talented and skilled, which a lot of these people are. So they're putting their talents and skills to use for free. Now, will that break the machine overnight? No. Is the next generation going to go to the voting booth and cast a vote on a Diebold machine? No, they're going to hack it themselves. This is where it's going.
even trolls can express themselves.
There you go. We're joined now by Jake Anderson. What's up, Jake?
Hey. Yeah, I agree with what you guys just said. Yeah, people, they're pissed off. Isn't this kind of what we wanted?
It is. That's what I'm thinking, man. You know, on one hand, the point I was going to bring up here was that a lot of people think about the energy that was poured into the Sanders campaign, and in that aspect, I'm kind of sad about all the wasted energy and stuff. But this is energy that would have been not used anyway, because there's nothing for young people to rally around. There's no anti-war movement. There's no, you know, there's no big movements to, you know, for people to rally around. I mean, there's the anti-police brutality movement, but that's been, you know, somewhat demolished by its own internal marketing and other things that have to do with that. And, you know, we were subject to some of the infighting when it comes to that aspect of things. You know, I guess the overall thing with the Sanders campaign is that, yeah, millions of people wasted their time on the Bernie Sanders campaign. When it came down to it, he turned around and endorsed Hillary Clinton, which was a huge letdown for many, many, many of his followers and stuff. But, you know, I just hope that the people that were part of that movement are willing to see what went on, are willing to recognize the issue here and continue the fight. And, you know, this is the same exact process I went through back in 2012. And Jake, you actually wrote a really good article about how Bernie Sanders can, you know, really continue, the Bernie Sanders revolution can still continue if it's willing to do certain things. So, I mean, what do you make of the remnant of the Bernie Sanders movement, and do you think there's any hope for these people to really affect change as of, you know, what we're seeing happening right now? Jake, I think you're on mute. I don't know. I mean, it's just, to me, I feel like these people can do so much if they're willing to put in the work. But if they're not, you know, it was just a big waste of time and a big waste of energy. But like I said, I mean, what
you
else?
You mean like the Olympics, Nick?
Yeah, kind of like the Olympics, right?
Dude, I was watching something today about how anybody from South America that was clowning on Trump needs to look at the wall that Rio built to separate all the favela from the rest of the inner city where the athletes are and the tourists are. They literally walled off the sections of the city around the hub, like with a huge concrete 20-foot wall, and armed it with guards on top with guns, dude, and then cleared out, I don't know, like 12 favelas. I don't displace like 250,000 people and just bulldozed all their homes. That is a waste of energy.
It's horrible, and it's kind of like how the DNC went and built a huge wall around the Democratic National Convention, right?
Yeah, and a whole lot of good it did. People just, you know, found a weak link in it and got through where no one was looking. So if somebody had wanted to, if it was important enough to somebody who really wanted to, they could have got in there.
Exactly. How ironic is it?
Well, it's all the securities for nothing. All it is a show of force. I mean, honestly, if you were savvy, you could have gotten there and done whatever.
Oh, too bad no one did, right? I was hoping for some more fireworks at the national conventions, and I was a little let down there.
Yeah, but you got to be – there's too many innocents, man, that have nothing to do with any of this. So if you're going to do crazy stuff like that, it needs to be pinpoint. We can't just be a 1,000-time equivalent of a drone strike, you know. But it'll probably happen in the course of events anyway. Planes fall out of the sky every day.
Oh, man. Yeah, wall builders, man, they love their walls. These people in power, I mean, that's all it is, dude. When someone's got power, they've got something to, you know, keep people out. They build walls around it to keep people out, and that's what's going on.
Nick, you gotta, maybe we should get somebody from down there to get an honest article written about the human cost of how many people's lives were actually ended to make room for the Olympics down there. How many thousands of gunfights probably erupted when these guys came in to bulldoze places where gangs had their territory, and they're armed. So firefights with innocents in between. I mean, that had to have been a war in itself, like the Olympics war.
Children are being put in jail over there in Brazil because they're protesting against the Olympics, and the you know, they're being evicted out of their neighborhoods and stuff. We've got actually, now that you say it, we've got a great article coming out tomorrow about the Olympics. We're working on we've got a working title, 5 Things Brazil Doesn't Want You to Know About the Olympic Games. So keep an eye on that for tomorrow. Hopefully the website is restored by then. God, we're still dealing with this issue with the website.
Nick, what happened. The next one's going to be held in northern Tokyo. It's going to be close enough to Fukushima.
Great place to put it, right?
I mean, are they trying to poison people so they go back now to every corner of the earth? Or what? I mean,
this other thing now too with the Olympics is that we got this outbreak of Zika down there in Brazil, and it's shown itself to be pretty, you know, viral, and I don't know. I mean, this thing with Zika is crazy because it broke out just less than a year ago, right before the...
Yeah, but they fumigated, like, all of Miami, and they were saying how Zika's, like, not even close to as contagious as whatever the... What was the last thing that was such a huge Ebola? One before Ebola. So Ebola apparently can go airborne, whereas Zika needs to be transferred by blood, so by mosquito. So why if there was a potential Ebola breakout, did they not fumigate? But now with this Zika virus, they're spraying everyone like bugs.
Yeah, it's crazy. So, you know, a bunch of people are going to be down there, and the authorities are saying, oh, Zika's not a problem here, and it's not going to be dispersed throughout the world by the Olympic Games. But, I mean, you got people from every country. I mean, what better place for a virus to spread its wings out and go global than, you know, the Olympic Games? Perfect place, perfect opportunity for a virus to infect people all over the world. So, I don't know, man. It's the Olympic Games are a mess, dude. And there's been plenty of criticisms of these big, huge, you know, sporting events. And rightly so, man. They do a lot of damage to try to make the place look good. Here in San Diego, in fact, we just had the All-Star game for baseball, and they went around sweeping up homeless people, dude, and putting up rocks where all the homeless people sleep. They like put rocks in there so they couldn't sleep there no more and stuff like that. And then the city of San Diego lied. They said that they put the rocks in because the community around there was complaining about the homeless, so they put them in there to keep them out. Leaked emails later on, of course, we come to find out that the city was lying, and they put the rocks in because of the All-Star game. You know, and so every time you have these big events in countries, the country that's hosting the event wants to go and give it a facelift and pretend like, hey, our country is so great and beautiful, we don't have any poverty or homeless or any issues that you got, violence or any of the stuff that everyone else has. And so they go and they try to paint over the fact that everybody around the world has a bunch of issues. And the poor people that are the ones that are kind of subject to these issues, in Brazil, you know, the people living in favelas, which are already poor, and, you know, these communities are infected by basically drug cartels and addiction and just sheer poverty. They get evicted out of their homes, and as if it weren't bad enough already. It's like, oh, you guys are poor, and a bunch of you are addicted to drugs, homeless everywhere. Okay, let's tear down your community so you really have no place to go. I mean, it's already bad enough you're living in houses made out of pallets and tires. Let's tear those meager dwellings down, and so you have actually nowhere to go. And so this is what's going on down in Brazil and Rio.
It's a disaster, Nick. Like, Brazil's always been on the side where the Amazon meets, has always been super fractured and having continuous conflicts with the indigenous peoples. And it's ripe, besides the fact that everyone there speaks Portuguese and everyone else around there is speaking Spanish, there's really not a lot connecting them. You know what I mean? Like, the outlying states could at any time just be like, screw the federal district in Brasilia, who continues to just tax us and obviously are just completely oppressing the people. Like, Brazil is a massively wealthy country. It could be like maybe the fourth richest in the world behind, you know, us, China, and Russia for actual power and GDP, yet it's so corrupt that it's third world. I mean, that's ridiculous when you live there.
Yeah, dude, it's so sad that's what's going on there. And for a long time, you know, the U.S. has supported several regimes in Brazil. And for some reason, the U.S. is always backing the most corrupted regimes down there. I don't know if it's just strictly to benefit their own.
Yeah, to keep them from being a threat.
Yeah, I mean, it's one for to make, you know, in the short run, it's like, oh, make us money. In the long run, it's like, keep them broken down so they can never challenge our, you know, status in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, that I think that plays a major role in the Monroe Doctrine. Keep these countries in especially Brazil, because it's so big and it's so rich in natural resources. Keep them so corrupt and keep them so messed up that they can never challenge our hegemony in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, if you look at the size and the natural resources, like you said, Brazil could rival the United States in power and economy, but they don't.
They're hydroelectric just because of the Amazon and all the rivers and basins powers their country. So they're totally renewable. And then all their fuel is met by their ethanol. So they're actually, for most average people there, their electric and their gas for their car comes from what they make renewably. So the average person there, even if they are poor, can still have a car sometimes because gas is so damn cheap and so is electric. I mean, ideally, if they could just spread some of the money out and educate their population, they could be first world.
They really could, man. They really could. I think Jake's back on. Jake, you there?
Yeah, I am. I'm connected to a Starbucks hotspot, actually, so I don't even know if you want to be talking to me because it could be hacked in or something.
Double cinnamon latte?
I'm not at Starbucks. I'm actually parked in a car outside Starbucks, and I was using my iPhone. Anyway, this is a boring story. Yeah, but Costa Rica, too, huge hydroelectric there. Yeah, man. I mean, we should be looking to those countries as models instead of completely supporting regime change down there.
Seriously, man. And that recent thing in Brazil could be, many have called it regime change or, you know, some type of policy coup with Brazil. Who knows? I don't know what really went on over there.
Venezuela is horrifying. I you know, Nick, I know people in Peru, so they're only separated by Colombia. And Colombia is just being completely overwhelmed. They're actually seeing the kind of waves that like Europe and Turkey was seeing from Syria, in masses of tens of thousands of people coming over because Venezuela is essentially a failed state. Colombia could barely absorb them, and they're having a hard time. So now, of course, Peru, because they're very wealthy, and the people there, even though they're again poor, a lot of their stuff's subsidized and socialized, they don't want more people coming in to take what they consider as their resources, so now they're considering building a wall on the Colombian border.
Oh, man. Just, you know, it's just a recurring theme here about failed governments and bad policies. In the Western Hemisphere in particular, it's, you know, the U.S. has had a heavy hand in what's going on in Venezuela, man. We've treated them very poorly because we were at odds with the Chavez government and stuff, and we disagree with the way that they run their government. And you know, the average Venezuelan is having to suffer at the hands of their own government, and then the U.S. government's meddling and all the crap that we're doing over there. Not a good scenario in South America for the most part for a lot of these countries, man. And you know, Brazil, you know, we got to expose what's going on down there. Hopefully the article tomorrow helps out a little bit, because you know, everybody likes to whitewash everything for these big, you know, whether it's the World Cup, which was also recently, I think in 2014 in Brazil, same kind of thing was happening, man. They tore down a bunch of the neighborhoods. They kicked out all the, you know, the people that they just thought were not, you know, cosmetically pleasing. And, you know, they just treat the poor people like shit, man. And it's just, it's got to come to an end. And we've got to stop supporting these things that you know, really put people in vulnerable positions.
People need to demand their ability to be able to self-sustain and not be forced to be on a grid to get their 40 acres and a mule, you know what I mean, and have the government provide that for them. Because it's obvious that, like we've alluded to many a time already, is there a hiccup in anything, in any supply chain? Many people could die, and we have to get away from that. I mean, even having a little yard garden, you could feed yourself. Everybody's always said you could make, you could feed a family of four with an acre, so that's really all we need.
Yeah, dude, and I saw recently that you could fit like every family in the United States into the state of Texas, and they could have like an acre of land. Have you
heard? Easily.
You know, and so the problem here isn't that there, we don't have the space for all the people in the, not only in the country, but in the world. It's that resources are allocated in a very inefficient way. I mean, the federal government itself owns like 600 million acres of the United States, most of it in the western half of the country. 600 million, that's enough for like 2 acres per person. You know what I'm saying? And so,
and many banks have misappropriated traditional lands by using eminent domain in collusion with the government to take land and then just sit on it and hold it. and just sit on it forever and never do anything with it, just like all the millions of homes they own, and they never ever put them back on the market, or they sell them to overseas investors. So they slowly, piece by piece, sell away our you know, our sovereign parts of our country that really should be used for people, to give them the option to not be on food stamps and assistance and go out and self-sustain.
Exactly, dude. And it's so important. And we've drifted so far away from self-sufficiency, self-reliance and stuff. And really that plays into the hand of these control freaks that are trying to tell us what to do and control our lives, because if we're dependent on them for mostly everything, well, then how are we ever going to challenge their authority? You know, and you can't help but wonder if this stuff is done by design, because it really strengthens their place and it weakens ours. You know, what kind of bargaining power do we have? What kind of leverage do we have against the government when nobody can even wipe their own asses anymore? You know, I mean, what are we going to do when they say, okay, well, you guys, you know, if a city breaks away or a state breaks away and says, hey, we're not playing your game anymore, we're not going to do, you know, like, for instance, if Texas, you know, Texas broke off and said, you know what, we're not going to play this federal game no more, we're not going to listen to what you guys have to say, and the federal government just cuts off all resources to them and stuff, well, what are they going to do?
Nick, I wanna bring something up that's like a growing thing that's I'm seeing, which is stuff like New Era Detroit is starting to take volunteerism to a real street level, and people are getting by without government services up there. So it may just be an organic, not even a breakaway, but literally like a, we're going to turn our back on everything besides the barter economy and volunteerism, and we're going to buy big plots of $500 acres and start planting crops and living up there. And when you see stuff like that happen, that could become kind of like the alternative way of life, where you can mix both. You can still have a modern lifestyle away from government that is overreaching because there's no tax base, and get into these micro communities for minimal investments. But people need to come together and make that a reality. I mean, it's something to think about going forward, because, like I said, a hiccup, there's a lot of problems. And then if we have a war, there's a huge lot of problems. So if you can just be far enough away to kind of do your own thing, but still have modern conveniences, it's like it's the best of all worlds.
Well, this is going back to what I was going to ask Jake about, is you know, the Bernie Sanders revolution. And I know a lot of these people were buying into this like hero complex, and they were like, oh, Bernie Sanders is going to fix it all and that kind of thing. I very... very naive in many ways to think that way, but you know, let's face it, that's how people think. You know, everybody wants a hero, everybody wants someone else to do something for them, everyone wants a lot out of things and only have to put a little bit in. Voting is something very easy. You don't have to, you know, you write a name on a paper or you press a button on a machine and then you expect a bunch of things to happen and everything to get fixed. I mean, a very lazy way about going about changing things, but I hope that the Bernie Sanders crowd is able to continue its revolution by tapping into some of these ideas of like agorism and you know, community oriented ideas, localism, and things like that, where you turn your back on the federal institutions that have been failing us and been corrupting and been conquering and exploiting people forever, basically, and start, you know, rewriting the rule book and rewriting the way things are done by going about it in a community oriented way.
And I was just gonna,
the way to affect real democratic change is by literally putting the control back into your own hands.
I was just gonna say, you know, as a pioneer program, even Nick, like, you could do it on a completely micro level, like just using Detroit as an example, where you still have a big city infrastructure built out, you can buy, you could buy like a whole street now for under $100,000 with houses. I mean, bring 10 friends in on it, $10,000 a piece, make a micro community. You all have backyards. You can find enough work there to maybe get by on what you can't grow. Things can be available now to get kind of semi off grid and get ready for maybe what might be coming, which is you gotta self-sustain. There's not enough jobs right now. And people aren't not having kids.
Yeah, man. Jake, you still on the line?
Oh, yeah.
So what do you think, dude? I mean, you think the Sanders people are open to any of these ideas, man, or are they just kind of lost in this, I'm going to vote for a guy and he's going to do it all for me idea?
I think it's part of a slow evolution. I mean, I don't think anything's going to change overnight. It's not going to change in 1 year. It's not going to change in 4 years. You know, like we've been talking about for a while, man, this is all part of a very slow evolution, and I think it's speeding up because of, you know, the internet and the rate of information transfer, and just the world is getting smaller and there's less space for lies to fly, I think. And so we're getting smarter, and I think the Sanders people, to answer your question, I think a lot of the Sanders people are now going to see the world very, very differently. I don't think that I can ever look at the Democratic Party the same. The Democratic Party will never be the same. So this, if it doesn't change them this time, it'll happen again in 2 years or 4 years, probably 4 years. But yeah, I mean, I don't know if the people will embrace agorism. I mean, I think it's generations before people start embracing, you know, radical self-reliance and individualism on a local level, on that kind of scale, because we just don't get educated about that kind of stuff in junior high and high school and college like we should. But that's going to change because the entire economy is about to change because of automation and how we produce energy. So that's my answer. It's going to take 30 to 40 years, I think.
Well, I think you're right, man. It's so easy to give up, and that's the thing too, is that the people listening here that were on the Sanders revolution train and stuff, don't give up, man. This is a fight that's been going on since humans started planting crops 10,000 years ago, when they started making cities and villages and started making city-states, and then city-states grew into empires and countries and all that stuff. People started building walls and drawing borders and all that crap. I mean, the poor people have been in a struggle ever since. You know, we've been kind of, the working people have been fighting against this oligarchy. I mean, oligarchy seems to be like an inherent trait of civilization, I guess, for humanity. And
you've always needed central organization just to survive until modern infrastructure was built. And then once the people at the top realized that, they worked to make companies the new monopolies, like the utilities. And people don't even need them anymore. You truly can go out there right now if you have enough to do it and go away and never have to come back again.
Yeah, dude. And you know, it's been a fight throughout the millennia. Think about the Greeks and when they, you know, quote unquote, invented democracy and how awesome it was for a period of time and how their civilization flourished, and then it turned into what it turned into, the Greek Empire, and then the Romans had their experiment in the Republican form of democracy, and then that turned into the Roman Empire and stuff. And people will have these great ideas, and for a period of time, you know, the fight for freedom will be advanced for a while, and then it'll regress. And right now, that's, you know, really what we're facing in the United States, is a regression of the idea of representative government. It's turning quickly into a very authoritarian style, whether it be through Trump or through, you know, Obama version of authoritarianism, which is what Clinton would kind of continue on, of just bureaucratic authoritarianism, or with Trump, maybe outright fascism. I mean, both of them are pretty bad. But it's a regression that, you know, it seems like all democratic societies go through, and plenty of philosophers have addressed this issue. But now we're at the stage in humanity where we can learn from our mistakes, and that's what we need to start doing. Learning from our mistakes, stop making the same mistakes. Thank you all. In the Outside Party Radio.
stereo, stereo. This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo.